Okay, thanks very much, Sean, and thank you to all the organisers for the opportunity to come to Santa Barbara for my first time here. It's a beautiful place to come. And having been given the opportunity to come here for almost 2 months to enjoy the programme and the place, when Joe asked me to give a talk introducing something about cosmology and also what the cosmologists want from the string theorists, then seemed a good opportunity, I guess, to, although it required some thought to decide what to say, it seemed a good opportunity to start off, first of all, so people show my face, so people know who I am, because there aren't so many people, there are a lot of people I don't recognize here. And also to show, hopefully, where I'm coming from when I think about cosmology and what sort of questions we hope to get some input from string theory. So the cartoon for the talk, I guess, is this. This is my rendition of what cosmology is. A black box for taking some initial state of space-time and matter and processing it into the observations which the astronomers are increasingly coming up with, increasing detail, increasing number of observations of what the universe actually looks like today. So cosmology, I'll try and argue, is quite a successful model now for processing. If you've got the right kind of initial state, you can process it into the sort of observations that are coming in. And that sort of standard model of cosmology invokes general relativity and particle physics, which I guess I will define fairly broadly to sort of go somewhat beyond the standard model of particle physics, but to include the sorts of things we imagine particle physics would do, for instance, producing the baryon asymmetry, for instance, in the universe is something we imagine coming out of particle interactions in the early universe. So so where does that leave for string theory? Well, the classic, and orange isn't going to show up very well, but the classic place where we look for some input from string theory is, well, where did that initial state come from that this, I claim, successful cosmological model acts on? Increasingly, these days, perhaps, people are also asking questions down here about where we're heading to and what's the final state for the cosmos, for our cosmological model. So I feel I should apologize a bit that as a cosmologist we tend to look to string theory to fill in the gaps in our own, so inevitably it's sort of beyond the stuff we think we understand, we start hunting around for ideas beyond that model. I appreciate that actually a lot of string theory is very concerned with actually getting these bits, but in cosmology we sort of take for granted that general relativity is a tool that we have to play with, much of particle physics is a tool that we have, and so we tend to take that much for granted, and we're really looking for the outstanding questions reside really, as I say, up at the initial state or perhaps the final state. So here's a statement again of what the cosmological standard model is, process of evolving this, what's actually quite a simple but at the same time special initial state, which I'll come back to, using general relativity and particle physics and turning it into observation, the observed distribution of matter and radiation in the cosmos. And here I've listed really just some of the sort of current tools that are used, observations that are used to constrain our cosmological model. So one of the classic sort of cosmological tests is the abundances of the light elements produced in Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So since the 70s, people have understood that the abundances of the light elements give us a constraint on, for instance, the photon to baryon ratio in the cosmos. Very much these days, there's a lot of activity, as you may have be aware, in studying the details of the statistics of the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background radiation. Radiation last scattered something like 300,000 years after the Big Bang, observed in the microwave today. Then a new emerging field is the distribution of hydrogen clouds along the line of sight in high redshift quasars. So there's increasingly good statistics now on the distribution of hydrogen at high redshift. And of course, we can see the bright stuff in the universe, galaxy clusters, as well as the local distribution, three-dimensional distribution of galaxies being mapped by large-scale galaxy redshift surveys, supernovae surveys, and we also have some information about the dark stuff in the universe through, for instance, gravitational lensing of background galaxies by intervening matter. And gravitational lensing is sensitive, of course, to the distribution of the dark matter in the universe as well. So there's a lot of information coming in, statistical information coming in from surveys, and there's now a big industry in cosmology taking some initial state and some model parameters and trying to fit all this data. And you get a long list of parameters in the standard cosmological model now, which are constrained by these kinds of observations. So I wanted to show you there's a long list of observations before showing you that there's a long list of parameters which you try and fit with them. In practice, people rarely fit as many parameters as this, but certainly 9 or 10 parameters are routinely, you do a statistical fit and see how well different parameter values match the observations. Now there's a long list there. Some are the sort of detail, for instance, the relative density of different components in the universe, baryons, photons, cold dark matter, neutrinos, given in terms of this dimensionless density parameter omega. And similarly, these days you see that the effect of the contribution of spatial curvature to the expansion of the universe is also characterized often in terms of omega. So if omega is 1, this stuff dominates. If omega is 0, it's irrelevant to the cosmic expansion. You also want to know about the sort of initial structure, large-scale structure of the universe characterized by metric perturbations. These quantities here, the scalar and tensor metric perturbations, that is the gravitational potential and the gravitational wave amplitude. And then there are some other sort of more astrophysical constants. So let me group these together to make sense of these a bit. There's too many there to make much sense of. And I think I would suggest you can group them together in this sort of way. Some of these really are telling us our descriptions of the initial state. So, okay, they're parameterizing our otherwise ignorance about the initial state of the universe. In particular, say, the spatial curvature of the universe is something you have to, is inherited just from the initial state, as is the sort of initial. In the standard cosmological model, this is certainly the case, as is the sort of spectrum of metric perturbations. But other parameters here, like the sort of relative densities of different matter components, the photon to baryon ratio, for instance, or the CDM, cold dark matter abundance, you expect to get out of the particle physics. So particle physics is here going beyond the standard model, but we expect, for instance, cold dark matter, there's a very simple picture of why the cold dark matter abundance is what it is today, simply assuming that it's the lightest supersymmetric particle and you've got some relic abundance from some thermal decoupling of that lightest supersymmetric particle. So almost standard particle physics, what goes into that kind of calculation. And so similarly, the neutrino density, if you have a prediction of the neutrino masses, then one would expect the neutrino density to follow from that in terms of some thermal abundance. So this is in the realm of fairly conventional particle physics, some of the parameters that end up being constrained is just astrophysics. It just parameterizes our uncertainty about the efficiency of star formation. So, you know, there's some, typically you'll find some parameters being fit that are really just astrophysics. The present Hubble constant here, I've just labeled here, really is just being a clock. It just tells you where you are. In a conventional cosmology, anyway, it's something which is decreasing. The expansion rate's decreasing with time. So it's a measurement of where you are in the cosmic history. It's nothing in that sense, nothing very fundamental. But then these last two parameters, so are seem to lie outside the sort of realm of conventional particle physics. What the contribution of the vacuum energy density is to the expansion, the cosmological constant problem, why it's just the value it is something. It's something the astronomers have gone and measured, but is in want of some kind of explanation. And the astronomers are also beginning to play around with measuring not just the sort of overall average density, the density of the vacuum at present, but also its actual equation of state. Of course, strictly a vacuum should have a pressure equal to minus the density, but the astronomers have the sort of data and have ambitions to get better data which would actually tell them if it was different from that. So this So in some sense, they're beginning to measure something about the dynamics of empty space. So here's my list of parameters, and as I say, I've grouped it up. And as I say, it's the obvious place where we're sort of looking for input from string theory is in terms of the initial conditions, the input parameters. But also, in some sense, this is a statement about the end, the final state of the cosmos, the sort of, or at least the present vacuum state. Where does that energy density or gravity of the vacuum come from? Sorry? Right, okay, well, at this stage it's just early. Let me see. I'm going to talk more about initial conditions, so maybe I should come back to that.
I mean, from the phenomenological
viewpoint,
you mean after
the heat? That's right. Yeah. I mean, so for astronomers, I'm often, when I talk about the initial state, astronomers would often talk about the primordial values of quantities. And often they mean, well, nuclear synthesis, for instance, is a good canonical time at which to talk about the initial state in a standard hot Big Bang model where you're just not going beyond known physics. So up to nuclear synthesis, we think we have a good picture of what the universe is made of, and so it makes sense to talk about, for instance, the distribution of density perturbations at that time. So that's a very conservative definition of what the initial state is for the standard cosmological model from nuclear synthesis onwards. I'm going to edge backwards a bit from that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, well, in the standard cosmological model, the initial the early equation of state is the pressure is a third of the density. It's just a hot relativistic gas, and then it becomes matter dominated. So, okay, it becomes effectively pressureless. But then, what the astronomers are finding is that you actually go into a regime where you're dominated by some negative pressure component, smoothly distributed negative pressure component, looks like a vacuum, but you can actually try and measure what that equation of state is. So it doesn't seem so in the standard hot Big Bang model, there's no variable equation of state. You know that the universe is made of hot stuff and cold stuff, and you know how the physics of that. But the physics of the vacuum is sort of a big question, and that's why that's left put in basically as something to go and measure, test against the data. Perhaps Sean or someone will tell us later in the workshop about what the answer is. Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to this initial state though, because that's the most uncertain thing in all of this. So the minimal sort of requirements for this standard cosmological model is, well, 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, right? That's all the cosmologists need. And it's almost homogeneous and isotropic. In fact, you can be slightly more careful, perhaps, in the statement and say that the assumption is that it's statistically homogeneous and isotropic. There are lumps over here and lumps over there in the universe, but the lumps over here look pretty much statistically like the lumps over there. So it's described by a perturbed Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time. And it's almost spatially flat. So the expansion seems to be dominated by the density of matter, of stuff, rather than spatial curvature, which also would come into the Friedman equation. An important point that's sort of obvious, but important point is that the universe is initially expanding, right? That's sort of, in the standard cosmology, has to be, you know, was something that's put in. And I just mention it because one of the problems I'll come back to is that actually if you started with a collapsing state, we don't know of, it's very difficult to turn that into an expanding state. So we start with an expanding cosmos, spatially flat, almost perturbed Friedman-Robertson-Walker. And the perturbations are about 1 part in 10 to the 5. These are the metric perturbations. But you do need some sort of initial, almost scale invariant spectrum of perturbations from which you then form galaxies and the structure of the universe from gravitational collapse. So these are all the sort of inputs that are, you can start basically from Big Bang nuclear synthesis onwards from this sort of input. And that's what's being parameterized by those initial parameters of parameterizing the initial state. Okay, so this is thus far a very modest view of what standard cosmology is. It's rather expanded these days in an attempt to understand these at least partially explain these particular initial conditions. We have an idea called inflation, which in its simplest guise is just some constant positive vacuum energy. And in that case, we know that there's an attractor solution, at least for a range of initial conditions, a de Sitter attractor. So that can drive the evolution towards a homogeneous and isotropic and indeed spatially flat cosmology. So that was why it was originally proposed. And the way it gets modeled usually is in terms of some slowly rolling scalar fields. The problem with de Sitter is it's just a time-invariant state, so you need some clock, some dynamics going on, and a scalar field is consistent with this approach to a homogeneous and isotropic space-time, where the energy density, the vacuum energy V of phi, for instance, is just a function of the scalar field phi. Classic picture of scalar field evolving down the hill. So to get something like de Sitter, you need an almost constant vacuum energy, a slowly rolling field. And then there's a huge bonus when you start studying the dynamics of these scalar fields, is that if they're light fields during an inflationary expansion, you automatically produce a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. So any light field, start off with vacuum fluctuations on small scales, that gets stretched up to give you a scale invariant, or almost, so if it's an almost constant vacuum energy, you get an almost scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. Okay, so at the end of inflation, so the scalar fields also give you the dynamics such that you can imagine there becoming a point where the field sort of rolls down its potential, oscillates about the minimum, and you reheat to produce a hot Big Bang, not a vacuum-dominated cosmology anymore, but a hot radiation-dominated Big Bang, and then the scalar field perturbations are turned into density perturbations, and you're away in terms of the, you can start the conventional hot Big Bang model with now an understanding of where the density perturbations could come from. So this is kind of my favorite subject. Let me just sketch a little more about where you get the large-scale structure of the universe from in this picture. So, as I say, it's just from considering, assuming the small-scale fluctuations, short wavelength fluctuations, are in the vacuum state, and inflation stretches up from a small-scale regime into a large-scale regime, where these perturbations become, instead of being freely oscillating under or underdamped oscillator, you move into an overdamped regime. So people talk about these, the perturbations getting frozen in on scales larger than the Hubble scale during inflation. So, and the classic result is that for a massless field, you get fluctuations at horizon crossing, you get fluctuations of order h over 2 pi, that's the Hubble rate at the time at horizon crossing. Now, these are just fluctuations in some obscure unknown scalar field, which we call the inflaton because we don't know necessarily what it is. But in simple models of inflation, there's a very nice way you turn fluctuations in some unknown inflaton field into real density perturbations in the hot Big Bang. And that's because it's just using geometry, really, or general relativity. These field fluctuations give you a metric perturbation. Here I've written as R, the co-moving curvature perturbation. It's just you turn delta phi field fluctuations into a dimensionless metric perturbation multiplied by h over phi dot, where phi dot's just the classical time evolution, and you get a dimensionless metric perturbation. And for simple perturbations, that is conserved from inflation through to the hot radiation or matter-dominated eras. This is in the large-scale limit for adiabatic density perturbations. You just calculate it once at horizon crossing or at the end of inflation, and then that sets up the large-scale structure of the universe. And it's just the geometrical perturbation that's inherited in the hot Big Bang era. But life can be more complicated than that, which you might not see in orange here. And there's been a lot of interest in the last year or so in models where you consider fluctuations in multi-field situations, which may be a move towards actually, so the hope is this is a move towards a more realistic description of inflation with allowing for many degrees of freedom. And then you get, as well as the sort of overall initial curvature perturbation, you get so-called isocurvature perturbations. This is the relative perturbations between different fields. And these can, well, one thing they can do is they can just produce relative perturbations between different matter components after inflation. So you can get, for instance, a perturbation in the photon to baryon ratio. That's something you can go and look for in the data. The data is very good at testing for this sort of perturbation. But also, they actually feed into the overall, can feed into the overall density perturbation. So it now depends on the physics, basically, of how field I and field J contribute to the final density perturbation. And so you have a more complicated modeling, if you like, but it may just be that you actually have to put some physics in. And so there's been discussion of this and so-called curvaton fields or modulated reheating, where you imagine one of these fields affecting the process of reheating at the end of inflation. So just to flag the fact that there are more sophisticated models of producing the density perturbation around, and there's a hope that you might, by looking for a broader class of initial perturbation spectra, be able to distinguish between different models for the origin of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so I would usually define the inflaton. You might have some multi-field dynamics actually driving inflation, but you can always define the inflaton to be, well, the overall trajectory in field space. So these other fields are just any orthogonal direction. So any light field, mass less than the Hubble scale during inflation, will acquire a spectrum of large-scale perturbations. Now, whether or not that feeds in, affects the final density perturbation, depends on whether that field plays a role in determining the final radiation or matter density, and there you have to put in some physics. So you know, the classic case, I suppose, in just in terms of pure isocurvature fluctuations, was that the phi I phi j, the orthogonal direction, could be just some maybe some axion field. You may not want to drive inflation with that field, but if it's light during inflation, it acquires a spectrum of perturbations, and at late times, that could affect the cold dark matter density.
I mean, the electroweak Higgs field is light on these scales with inflation at the Higgs scale.
So if you can find that in the scalar sector, and it doesn't, I mean, you have to worry about whether they receive some correction to their mass during inflation, I guess, because the inflaton is displaced from its minimum. So maybe it has some coupling. But that's right, but it could be, people have started looking at, it's a way of actually making a connection between real specific particle physics models, which we know are not very good. People used to try and drive inflation, identify the inflaton with something like the Higgs. And that's, I think, basically impossible. But now you can start asking, well, hang on, well, maybe the Higgs is still there, and maybe it still acquires a spectrum of perturbations, but it's not actually dominating during inflation, but of course it's important subsequently. And you can actually go and, but you have to go and do the work then to actually figure out how it affects the final, how fluctuate, if you did perturb that Higgs field during inflation, how it turns into a late time density perturbation. And as I say, there's, people have been playing around with models of how to do that, and but there's been a lot of activity in that precisely because it can give you a link between some of the particle physics and inflation. Yeah, they have. That's right. So you have to be light to get a spectrum of fluctuations, and that means they satisfy the slow roll conditions, whether or not they're actually participating in the evolution during inflation is. It would be nice. It's not one of the questions I've phrased as such, and I don't know really whether. I mean, I want to know what drives. What drives inflation? Yes. And that's a pressing question, not just in the early universe, but actually today. Because the universe appears to be accelerating today. There appears to be some vacuum energy today. So yes, I would like to know from string theory what drives the dynamics of the vacuum. And if it's an inflaton, which is just a scalar field you can point to in string theory, that would be, scalar degree of freedom, that would be great. But plus, yeah, that's right. I need to know its potential. But I can give you some hints there, right? Because I can give you some information about its potential if we follow through the phenomenology of it. So here's a sort of moving on to the sort of pushing the boundaries of what one might consider the standard model of cosmology. Here's a way that the quantum, a more ambitious way to use quantum fluctuations during inflation, actually think about this as the fluctuations as being a paradigm for almost the origin, or at least the continuation of the self-perpetuation of the inflationary universe. This picture of stochastic inflation studied by Starobinsky, Linde, and Vilenkin, and others, where you really consider the effect of the quantum fluctuations on the overall dynamics. And in particular, they pointed out that generally, it's at high energies that the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field can be larger than the classical evolution. So to model this, they have a sort of stochastic model of the effect of the fluctuations on a Hubble region. In a Hubble time, you get a kick from the quantum fluctuations, and you build up this alluring picture of a self-reproducing inflationary universe. So even if the universe starts down here at the bottom of the potential, quantum fluctuations can and in a few rare cases will kick you up the potential into a regime where you can start inflating. And the more you inflate, the more you get quantum fluctuations up the potential, and you've got this sort of eternal inflation picture. So this is the closest inflationary cosmology comes, I think, to giving you a picture, a real picture for the initial conditions of the universe, a sort of trying, the wish here anyway is to give you a sort of a complete initial picture for initial conditions. But you can, but this could do with some input, probably, in terms of actually really understanding whether, for instance, this is a consistent picture of gravitational back reaction of what are, in origin, quantum fluctuations, and now the universe is becoming, dynamics is becoming dominated by this. So do we have proper control of the proper description of what's going on here? Most of the evolution is modeled in a sort of, it's a semi-classical modeling that one's doing. There's also a question as to whether this really provides an absolute initial condition, because Vilenkin, Bohr, and Guthan have pointed out a problem of geodesic incompleteness, that there are geodesics which are past incomplete in this picture. So although it's future eternal, it appears not to be past eternal. So if I understand that right, that seems to suggest that you're still having to start it off somehow. Even if you then become, in the future, you become insensitive to how you started it off, there's still perhaps a fundamental question there. And also, there's always a problem of measure in this. That is, if you want to use a model like this to tell you what the most probable values for constants or quantities in the universe today is, then how do you weight the probability of the quantities in this region compared with this region compared with that region? You know, so how do you do that sort of comparison? So, I mean, this is a very, so I think, I mean, I find this a very alluring picture, but conceptually it's quite, there's a lot of challenges there still. That's right, that's right. So that's the that's the anthropic bit coming in here, right? That is exactly the kind of issue that comes cropped up in the interpretation of probabilities in this sort of model. Well, right. Well, the picture I've shown is, I've suggested that you go into this very inhomogeneous regime on large scale. So yeah, that sounds like a red spectrum, large perturbations on large scales. But large here really means, you know, way outside the observable horizon. So, you know, we're living inside some patch, and as long as it's almost scale invariant on observable scales, then I'm happy. So technically you could call it a red spectrum, but in terms of the observations, you know, you don't see that large scale stuff. You want to know what's going on small, finite range of scales. So in the future, your horizon might expand and you might begin to see all this stuff coming in, depending on what the final state is and whether we have a horizon or not. But you might begin to see inhomogeneity out there. Again, you can go and test, try and look for it in the observations. Yeah, so they construct. Well, so they, this is actually claims to be a very general argument. I mean, I don't, which I've not. Yeah, so they just assume you have a cosmology where you have a positive Hubble, local Hubble rate everywhere. Well, I think in this latest version with Guth, I think they claim that it's just geometrical. I mean, I'm going beyond where I've really, the detail that I've looked at the papers.
Hubble map is positive, you're assuming something about the curvature. So that is what you need. The energy condition would be superfluous. In fact, you better be violating energy conditions or you'll never get it.
Yeah.
No, the no energy condition is satisfied by inflation.
Eternal, but the quantum fluctuations here in Fottingham, yeah. Yeah, so there's an earlier version which may have relied on energy conditions. I think the paper with Guth becomes just a geometrical condition. Okay, so this is a string cosmology meeting. I should turn to possible alternatives to inflation proposed by one of our organizers, Gabriele, and Maurizio Gasparini is also here. And renewed attention is focused on this with the work of Curie over at Steinhardt and Turek in the last couple of years. So instead of having an inflationary initial stage, one should consider something which comes out more directly from the low energy string theory action, effective actions, from dilaton gravity, vacuum solutions. And so Gasparini and Veneziano proposed a pre-Big Bang model, which they'd approve of the description, it's sort of the gravitational instability of the vacuum, vacuum solution in string theory. So you're just using actually the low energy effective action to describe what you find is collapsing solutions. You get instability towards collapse. That's generically what you find in gravity. And this collapse locally looks like a cosmological collapse. Now, this might not sound very promising as a way of producing the large-scale structure of, producing the observed large universe, but actually there are some important similarities with an inflationary expansion. So this is an accelerated collapse. What you find, generally, is that there is a local homogeneous attractor solution, which in the sort of standard GR is known as the approach to a velocity-dominated singularity when you is the generic solution as you in gravitational collapse. So that looks like a locally homogeneous solution. And if you look at vacuum fluctuations in a field, you find that they go from the small-scale vacuum regime into this large-scale overdamped regime. So you have, in principle, a mechanism of producing large-scale perturbations. And I think these two properties are really shared by both the ekpyrotic model and the original pre-Big Bang model. And the same questions, though, arise in both, which are, firstly, you're approaching a cosmological singularity, so what are you going to do when you get to the singularity? That's a big question, which I'll come back to. And there's also a practice, even if you can find a way of around this problem, do some patching between an collapsing and expanding universe, for instance, there's also the question as to whether you actually produce a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations on large scales. You don't have a setup which naturally produces scale invariant perturbations in the way that De Sitter has this sort of scale invariant, is a scale invariant solution in a sense. So it very automatically produces scale invariant spectra in light fields. So you have to do something more in the collapse type models. It may indeed be possible to do that. You probably have to do it through producing some kind of initial isocurvature perturbations, which feed into the final curvature perturbation. In the context of conventional cosmological perturbation theory, that's what I would think you have to do. One could spend a lot of time talking about the pros and cons of that. But that's my not so brief introduction to cosmology, right? Some of the issues that are general issues in current issues in cosmology. Now let's throw some questions to string theory. And the first one I think is really the big one, and follows on automatically from any discussing the pre-Big Bang type collapse models. So what does happen at a cosmological singularity? Doesn't have to be a pre-Big Bang type cosmological collapse. You can just ask the question, if you look back towards the Big Bang that we see in our past, what actually went on back at the singularity. And perhaps I should just leave it as a question, but to sort of expand on the sort of the possible, the sort of approaches that I think have been adopted, you know, some of the approaches that have been adopted. Well, one hope is just that you add in corrections and they're going to you know, put in the next order correction to the tree level action, and maybe that'll avoid the singularity. I mean, I think the status there probably is that there are indeed correction type terms you can put in that avoid singularity for particular solutions, but it doesn't seem to be a general resolution, a way of avoiding a singularity per se. There are generally, you add in a particular correction term and you'll find that you, for certain solutions, you still go towards a singularity. So you'd have to put in another term and another term. So one would like something more fundamental. So one would like to be able to say that maybe there's some non-singular description, maybe there's a dual description of what looks like a bad solution. Perhaps we have a non-singular description in some other terms. That's a big challenge which people are aware of. But it's oh right. So there's various kinds of Big Bang, or it's time reverse, a Big Crunch. I just flag this up because it's a nice word name which Rob Caldwell came up with. Astronomers, I said, were playing around with astronomical tests of what the equation of state of the vacuum is at present, and there's some of the observations seem to marginally favor, it's nothing strong, but you can test the possibility that you actually have an unstable vacuum which with a pressure less than minus the density, so this is also called phantom matter. But if you just follow through the dynamics of that into the future, what you find is that not only is our expansion accelerating, but it accelerates so much that it rips, the universe rips open in a finite time in the future. So it's a sort of big singularity. It's the sort of thing which, just playing with the astronomical observations, you can actually try and see, well, you know, is that the equation of state we see for the universe at present?
So the scale factor goes to infinity in finite time?
Yeah. So it's a pole singularity. So
it also has a Hubble constant for
the... Go to infinity in a finite time. Yeah, I mean, that's...
But it's still a space-like singularity.
Still space-like, though. Well, these are still just in the context of Robertson-Walker models. So, yeah.
David, I think perhaps a more general question with string audience could be the following. I mean, if you take the low-energy effective action of string theory and you look at generic solutions, mm-hmm. I bet that the generic solution is singular somewhere if you work at the lowest order level.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like in general relativity. I mean, you get initial data and typically you will end up in a singularity somewhere, space-like, time-like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what are string theories supposed to do with those solutions? Throw them away, analyze them better, or stick just to the zero measure subspace of non-singular solutions?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another way, more general than cosmology.
Yeah. So it's a big question. I mean, so the next question is sort of almost not unrelated, but needn't necessarily be the same. I mean, just it's a somewhat vague question, but in our cosmological models, how should we begin our cosmological models with or without a singularity? You know, if we avoid this, so suppose you've got some non-singular cosmology, but should we... So we could have, so, you know, should we be modeling our cosmology as some eternal cosmology from past infinity through a Big Bang to the present? That's the sort of pre-Big Bang model. The ekpyrotic model has become the cyclic model where you have some eternal cyclic evolution. Or is stochastic inflation, can you make a consistent, eternal, self-consistent model of stochastic inflation which doesn't require some input? Very general questions. I mean, a more modest thing might be to put in, should we begin with some quantum Euclidean era, do quantum cosmology with a suitable boundary proposal? So, somewhat diffuse question, but it's important. That's how we build our cosmological models. We need that sort of information. A lot of the questions I realized that cosmologists are asking these days is really about the vacuum, and so a description, well, it's just a quantum gravity, quantum gravitational description of the vacuum is required for a really complete understanding of lots of the things that we're probing in cosmology. I've talked about the power spectrum of fluctuations. Really, I'm talking about the two-point function for fields in a curved space-time background, which I can get from just linearly evolving a vacuum solution on small scales through to large scales. But cosmologists, there's been some attention paid recently to the question of whether that's picking up the sort of what's basically the Minkowski vacuum solution on small scales is appropriate for modes that start in a sub-Planckian wavelengths. Well, so this sort of trans-Planckian problem has been aired as to what's the correct vacuum state to use on small scales, because we think we're observing on the larger scales in the universe today the initial vacuum state. Or so have we got the right, we would be sensitive potentially to effects from sort of sub-Planck physics which has got stretched up to large scales. Well, that's just in terms of the two-point function. Of course, what you really would like to know is also what beyond that, what's really so the next place to look, I suppose, is the three-point function of self-gravitating fields. It's okay. That's what quantum gravity, I suppose, should tell us. But again, this is something which, in principle, we test, because if in these inflationary models, it's from the small-scale vacuum fluctuations you get the large-scale structure of the universe. Now, the large-scale structure we observe is consistent with Gaussianity, a Gaussian distribution of density perturbations, but we can, in principle, measure deviations from that. So if there's non-Gaussianity in the sort of vacuum state, we would be sensitive to that, but we need to know what the input should be there. So, yes, that's right. I mean, yes, right. And it may well be that the predicted non-Gaussianity is below the observable signal. And yes, that's right. And I don't know how to give that in a generic sense, what those perturbations are. It's a question to ask. And I don't know how far you can push it, how much. It's probably just the number of, just the number of pixels on the sky you can measure. Maybe if you keep going to smaller scales, you can push harder and harder the Gaussian limit. Yeah. So. Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess with the CMB, it's sort of limited by resolution. So if you had really... Yeah, that's right. So you have cosmic variance that says you've got so many pixels on the sky. If you had lots of really small pixels, you start going into the nonlinear regime anyway. So, yeah. So, but it's something which is going... People are measuring, testing now for Gaussianity. So that was about the sort of fluctuations, but there's, of course, this question as to what almost like the background solution is for the vacuum state. In where are we heading in our cosmology today? Many sort of cosmologists are playing around with models now which are trying to model the present low value of the vacuum energy by assuming, well, presumably it's just rolling its way down to zero, and some quintessence or dark energy field that's gradually going to zero. Maybe it's going to a finite value, or maybe it's just a constant, cosmological constant, and the future is de Sitter expansion. But there's also this picture of Kalosh Linde and others suggesting that maybe we're just sitting on some metastable or unstable maximum of the potential, and we're just kind of heading towards another cosmic catastrophe where you roll down, where the potential may be even unbounded from below, certainly going negative, and that's enough to give you a recollapse in the future. Yeah.
From this point, the extra dimensions can get big.
Yeah, well, that's my final question, right? So I should move on to my final question. So anyway, so there's a lot of observers, just to say about the vacuum state, observers can measure, astronomers think they have measured the energy density of the vacuum, or at least how the expansion due to the vacuum. So the other way of phrasing the question, which I think Dvalli and others like to put it, is why does the present vacuum weigh so little? Maybe it's something about gravity. It's obviously a question which lies outside particle physics as such, because this is what happens when you've taken all the particles out of the universe. What's left? What's the gravity of that? So there's the question of why it's just today, the coincidence problem of why we, comes in today. So, well, these questions have been asked a lot in different ways. So the final question is the obvious one. Why are there only three large spatial, or at least three visible dimensions? And which wasn't a question which necessarily as a cosmologist you would come up with, but as a string theorist I think you have to cut you. If you believe there are extra dimensions, so why have we got three large observable dimensions? And probably I don't really have much original to say in that. I suppose I was going to mention the fact that you could also, a related question is, what's the topology of space? Because again, that's something which astronomers at least are interested in measuring. You look at the microwave background sky, you can look for signatures of a sort of compact topology, at least if it's small enough that it's within our observable horizon. And there's sort of been some, there's some intrigue, interest coming from the WMAP, that's the microwave background, latest microwave background anisotropy results, because there's there's less power on the largest scales in the universe than perhaps you expect, although it's not very statistically significant, but there are ways of phrasing the question which make it sound more statistically significant. depending on how you ask the question, you can get a... So there's suggestions that maybe the octopole, I think it's the quadrupole and the octopole, the lowest multipoles actually line up. So things that you might, are not expected in a Gaussian random field that I was talking about from inflation, but maybe if you've got some, maybe it's a signature of topology in the universe. There's also, just in the last week, I was noticed going back through the archives and noticing there's talk about systematic differences between the microwave background anisotropies in one hemisphere and the other. And I've no idea what the sort of status of that is. There's a couple of papers, though, preprints in the last week on that. So maybe there is something strange on the larger scales in the universe. Again, it would be a big coincidence problem as to why it happens to be, some large scale happens to be the scale of the observed, our presently observable universe. But they're fascinating questions to ask. So by way of summary, cosmology. Successful model seeks a deep, meaningful connection with string theory, right?
No weirdo.
So it's, so cosmology seems to work quite well, but there are in all sorts of ways we don't think it's a, one's looking for a deeper explanation of why the cosmos is the way it is. Similar in that sense, I guess, the standard model of particle physics, right? You've got a model that works with certain parameters, but where do those parameters come from? By way of sort of, I suppose I'll leave you with the five questions that I put up there by way of provocation for now or the rest of the workshop. Thank you.
More questions?
Yeah.
What's your view about how the experimental situation is going to change in the next, let's say by the end of the decade? Are things going to look a lot different? Are whole new windows going to open up? Or do we know for the next half dozen years?
No, in the immediate future, the WMAP have just come out, just earlier this year came up with the first year's data, right? And that's a four-year experiment, and that immediately, you know, the next 4 years, will give us an improved view of, and it already made a sort of big leap forward. Perhaps we won't get quite the excitement of, you know, a big leap like that, but that's a lot of the issues like about the primordial perturbation spectra are going to get improved with the next few years' data on that. And then after that comes the Planck satellite. So the CMB for the rest of this decade, as it were, is going to keep providing new information. Then perhaps it begins to run out of steam. There are a lot of astronomical sort of conventional, more conventional astronomy things which are going to give us more information about, you know, distribution of galaxies, distribution of Lyman alpha clouds. As a cosmologist, as a theorist, theoretical cosmologist, I worry that that's not going to be quite the same clean data. So you're going to have lots of statistics, and the astronomers are going to start learning lots about galaxy formation, basically, from that. But whether we get primordial information is not quite so clear. Yeah, so that's right. I mean, one of the big... So there are experiments devoted to trying to measure any tensor contribution, that is gravitational wave contribution to the large-scale microwave background anisotropies. But again, it's one of those things that we don't know the level they're at. So they will push that. So maybe if we're lucky, they make a detection, and that would be a huge jump forward. But
synthetic models of inflation had some kind of prediction, right? For that, for TRX.
Well, I wouldn't. I don't buy that line. What but you will hear that said.
Is
the tilt also? Yeah, but how small is a slow roll parameter? But you don't measure it until you've got the gravitational wave signal. Really, the tilt measures another. So, I mean. It's obviously something one has to go after, but there's no, I mean, my take on it is that there's no guarantee that you're going to see tensor modes. Great, let's go and look for them, but there's no lower limit almost to how small they can be. Or we have to maybe be lucky there. If inflation's at a high energy scale, at the gut scale, you'll see gravity waves. If inflation's at the TV scale, you won't. Now, there's a prejudice in favor of gut scale inflation, perhaps, but I'm not convinced enough by any given model of inflation to believe the energy scale.
So, I thought there was already observational constraints on the scale of inflation.
There are upper limits, yes.
They're upper.
Yeah. Yeah, which is basically, does actually come really from the. Precisely from the limits on the limits on the gravitational wave amplitude, yeah.
So I would actually plan a more forthcoming observational thing.
Yes, yeah.
The LISA satellite
will
go up and will look for not only coalescing black holes, but it's tuned to look at for gravitational waves from the electroweak phase transition, if that's
right.
From the first order. Then colliding bubbles electroweak phase transition will be observable by LISA. The direct detection of dark matter is one that is plausible anyway in the next 10 years. There's a huge amount of parameter space you might not cover at all. And precision measurements of the equation of state, the dark energy.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
So
yeah.
SNAP.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, SNAP also cluster surveys and weak
yeah.
energy and other things. But one
yeah.
way or the other, we'll get it much, much better.
That's right, yeah. I mean, with the gravitational wave direct detection as well, I think there's talk of doing future gravitational wave detection may actually go up and look in a window away from where the astrophysical signals are. I mean, that's not going to happen until we've seen some astrophysical signals, but then you might go and look in a wave band where you don't have where you're not dominated by an astrophysical background of gravitational waves. But yeah, that's right.
LISA detection's not tomorrow either.
No, but it might
well,
be
10 years, yeah.
More questions?
that those corrections are putting some strain on the geometry of the universe in current subspaces, open, you know, geometrically open or closed, or that's still an open question?
Well, the so the it's quite. So the way it's tended, the way the it's the parameter that's measured is how much does the curvature contribute to the expansion rate,
yeah, but that
and it's
sure.
It's not much. It's less than probably well certainly 20% or 10% or so at most of the expansion comes from the curvature. So that gives you a limit on the curvature scale in an open or a closed universe. But you see if you're trying to say whether it, but I don't. If it is, so, but currently it's consistent with any of those possibilities, you just limit the curvature scale within those.
If it's, I understand it, if it's open, I think there are possibilities where you avoid the emission singularity. There's a model now called the emerging universe. There are models that can start off as Einstein static universe. And
Yeah, that's right. So people have been talking about the evidence. So by measuring, I mean, one of the classic tests of the microwave background is you measure the position of the peak, the first peak in the power spectrum, and that's supposed to be a good measure of the geometry of the universe because the angular scale that corresponds to, and it's pretty close to where you would expect it to be for a flat universe. Now, there's some evidence that maybe a closed universe is marginally favored, so the peak in the likelihood distribution seems to be with a slightly closed universe. And people anyway like the concept of a closed universe, and so people have looked at models of inflation that are closed, but they have to be very finely tuned. So, yeah, and I think there's papers by George Ellis and others looking at recently at a closed model that starts as an Einstein static universe and then. So it's a way to get at least in principle, non-singular model. But it's a very, you know, so you have to really tune the amount of inflation to do that, and there's probably questions. I don't know how well you know what the spectrum of fluctuations is on the curvature scale, for instance, because it's not dragged up from small scales up to large scales in the way that in the standard inflation picture, you just throw away these sort of, you push the curvature scale and all the sort of initial conditions outside the horizon. So if the universe really is flat, we'll never know it's exactly flat. Is I think my the sort of theorist take on it. You can always be because you can never prove something's exactly one. It'll be one plus or minus so much, and that's at the moment that's sort of where we are. It's one plus or minus 0.1.
Let's take one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. I think the proposal is that you actually can start with this Einstein static universe, and plus it's an unstable point. It's a saddle point at which to start, basically, I think, and so it's a very fine-tuned solution constructed to,
All right, let's thank you.